Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast by radio amateurs with a focus on homebrew electronics. From our workshops in Juneau, Alaska and London, England, we get together on the Echolink system to swap ideas about radio construction projects. Our website is www.soldersmoke.com. Please send feedback to soldersmoke, that's one word, at yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke.
KL7R, KL7R, M0HBR, are you there, Mike?
Yeah, M0HBR, KL7R. Good morning, Bill. How are you doing today?
Good, it's a good morning. I can look out the window here on the 9th of December at 0635 Greenwich Mean Time. Out the window I can see the moon, and right next to it, Saturn. And I was just out in the yard with the telescope taking a look at Saturn and its moon, Titan, and the rings, and drinking coffee. All is good in the universe. Mike, KL7R, M0HBR.
Oh, yeah. That's kind of the one of the mornings you write down in that book, and you keep filed away for when you could use a good memory there. Well, that sounds great. Hopefully with some excellent coffee. Being up as early as you are there, Bill. Things aren't so bad here. I'm happy it's the weekend. Had kind of a tough week of work, but it's over. It's the weekend. I got plenty laid out. I kind of wiped out last week from all the snow shoveling. We had a bunch of snow on the roof, so I had to get up there and shovel. And I guess I probably didn't have to with the metal roof. It probably would have slid off, but it was a lot of weight there. One of my friends calculated something like 90 pounds per square foot or something like that with 4 feet of wet snow. Nothing much happened, just sore backs. Had my greenhouse. I made a greenhouse out of some discarded covers for a tape robot. IBM has a long tape robot tunnel, and on the top of the tunnel is some plexiglass, and I scavenged some of the plexiglass when they threw away one of our tape robots, and I built a greenhouse out of it, and it finally collapsed after something like 5 years of duty there. Bill, go ahead.
You know, you and I are on the same frequency, Mike. It's really eerie. I mean, you're up there in Alaska, and I'm over here in London, and a lot of times we're involved in the same projects, even if they're really, really unrelated to ham radio. First on the weather, you got the snow, but hey, we had a tornado. I was sitting in the embassy, I guess it was day before yesterday, and man, the skies got dark and the wind started blowing and there was lightning in the middle of December. It was really weird. And I found out later on that just a couple miles to the northwest, a hurricane touched down, did some serious damage. I don't think it was too cool because some people were hurt, and it's not all that rare here. I think they get about 30 a year in the UK, but wow, it was certainly surprising. And so we have our weather story here today to Mike. And and as far as the greenhouse, I am involved in a similar project at work. They gave me a new office, and it has some really good southern exposure, and it's got these really big windows, and so I don't have much of a green thumb, but I am probably the only one who is actually growing food inside the United States Embassy here in London. I'm growing beans. I found an old pot full of some old dirt from flowers that died, and I rigged it up there, and it's in the window, and it gets the southern exposure, and beans are actually growing. KL7R, M0HBR.
I want to be around you when things go rough. You can make food from air. That's a good skill there, Bill. Wow, tornadoes in England. I had no idea. I was talking to my wife's aunt, and they live in Pennsylvania, and they get tornadoes there infrequently, but they get them there. But to me, it sounded really odd that they were getting tornadoes in December. I was talking to them, and Uncle John. I was talking to Uncle John, and Uncle John had been out riding his motorcycle. I think he's about 75 or 80. He's out riding his motorcycle. He said, "Yeah, it was 70 degrees, and I was out riding the bike." And then I talked to him again, and it's 15 degrees, and a tornado had passed within 30 miles of their house. So extreme weather. I saw a thing on one of the Google videos or something like that about a tornado in the United Arab Emirates, I think it was. I have a hard time with that one there, Bill. Go ahead.
Yeah, things are pretty strange. We have a lot to talk about here. Well, we forgot to mention the number. It's Solder Smoke 43. Yeah. Well, Saturn was a particularly good thing for me to look at today, because this week I had a chance through work to talk to one of the guys that put the probe on Titan. And what an amazing project. His name is John Czarnecki. He's here in the UK. He's up at Open University. And I had a chance to meet him. And it's just amazing to talk to somebody who's been involved in a project that can talk about your ultimate technological project. I mean, let's build a machine with lots of radios in it, send it off into space and have it land and transmit images back to us from Saturn's moon Titan. So I was out there this morning with the telescope, and you could see the rings. With my little telescope, you could see the divisions, the Cassini division in the rings of Saturn. And then off to the side there, you can see Titan. And just thinking about the project and sending up something there. Oh, Mike, it makes our double sideband transmitters seem very puny in comparison. What a cool project that is. KL7R, M0HBR.
Oh, you've had some real opportunities to bump into some interesting fellows. I remember, I think it was the Titan landing where they had a little pancake-shaped probe, and they could tell by the Doppler change on Earth that the thing had landed. I thought that was fascinating, and the fact that they sent pictures back that looked like a dirty mud puddle, could have been my backyard. pretty cool stuff. Speaking of spacey stuff, I bumped. Somebody sent a note to QRPL here in the past day or so, talking about the big X-class flare that we had and all the geomagnetic activity, and they had a pointer off to heliotown.com, and I can recommend that site. You have to go when you go there. It's got some really cool stuff about audio recordings of the sun in stereo at two different HF frequencies, and it's also got Doppler recordings of forward scan Doppler of shuttle reentries. You go there, and it's got stereo recordings of two different remote FM frequencies. And you can hear strange snippets of FM audio coming through as the shuttle ionizes the air and picking up all these different cities. But a mild warning about heliotown.com is the guy is an artist, and he's got some out there ideas and some out there art. Really pretty fun to crawl around in there, Bill. M0HBR, KL7R.
Yeah, I was just listening, and this is what I got. No, just kidding. I just wanted to play with the sound effects here, Mike. Yeah, I know about all of those sites are really interesting, and there's some great stuff on the videoized portions of the web I saw the one that you referred to, very interesting, and I have on the gadgeteer.us video page, if you scroll down a little bit, there's a good one there with some audio and video from solar flares, and it's really fascinating stuff. And the one that I had actually related the what was in the audio and video to, I think he related it to Ampere's law and Maxwell's equations. So it's a cut above what you normally get on YouTube. The YouTube videos very rarely get close to Maxwell's equations, but this one did. So our listeners might wanna take a look and a listen there. What else we have in that area? We'll have to put this up on the web pages. I put some new stuff on Gadgeteer News on the news page of gadgeteer.us. Some of the stuff we've been referring to, and that'll be up there. And I think the people have been asking us to do that, so I've been doing more of that. I put up the bit about homebrew tubes. We've been talking about the tradition of homebrewing your own vacuum tubes. And I found the paragraph from 200 meters and down and put that up there. So I think people might get a kick out of that and a few other things. Hey, I found something. I was looking at your site and from some of your bookmarks, and I found something that I found really interesting and useful, and that's that QEX article on why or how antennas radiate. And I'm reaching over here to pull it off out of the pile of paper that we have here, and I want to really recommend this one because I thought it was great. Paper shuffling. Hold on. Yeah, why antennas radiate. It's on Mike's bookmark pages, January February 2005 issue of QEX by Stuart G. Downs, WY6EE. Really good stuff. I really like this article. It's got everything in it. It's got the math. It's even got a bit of English poetry, which I thought was a nice touch. But the thing I liked most about it was it really it included in the description of the EM waves the role of special relativity, and that shows up occasionally, but then a lot of times it's left out. And when they leave it out, I think it leaves out a lot of the more interesting parts of the electromagnetic wave generation, which is, I guess, what this is all about. My KL7R M0HBR.
I found that article really interesting, but clearly you got more out of it than I did. I never made the connection he was trying to make as to why they radiate. They do radiate, and they have math to describe the radiation, but I'm not sure it said in there why they radiate. Maybe it's not a why. Maybe it's a how they radiate. We got a new ham in town, and he said, I'm coming to Juno, and I happen to be the club webmaster, and so he sent a note, and I invited him over here when he finally got here, and we started talking. He said, oh yeah, I built an ATS-3. I built a KX-1 and a K-1, and so he's a real QRP-er. And then he goes on. He says, yeah, I'm a PhD. I'm working on my PhD in plasma physics and on auroral studies. I said, oh, this is interesting. Maybe I'll finally learn how Maxwell's equations work. And I asked him, so what do you think about ether? And his eyes rolled up, and he looked a bit bemused. And finally, he said, well, you know, he's a plasma physicist, so he was talking about, you know, even one electron per cubic meter is a plasma. And I said, well, is that what a radio wave propagates through, a plasma? And he said, no. And I said, well, what does it propagate through? What is the ether? And he thought a while, and he said, I don't know if I really believe in ether, but if I had to label the ether, maybe ether is space time. And I'll turn that one over to you there, Bill. Over.
Yeah. heavy stuff. Yeah, it is. It's really. I mean, it's the core. When I was a kid, trying to learn ham radio, I wish somebody early on had told me that nobody really understands it all at a certain level. But even in Stewart's article, it's good because he very frequently points out where the kind of limits of understanding are, because he goes through the whole wave theory, not with the wave explanation of EM waves. And then at one point, I think he says, oh, yeah, there's also a particle theory, but we're not going to go into that very wisely. I thought the article was really good. Yeah, the way there's some really good books that take Maxwell's equations and kind of try to make them digestible for mere mortals like me. and I found one of them. It's called Einstein's Heroes. And I'm trying to. I have it in the books section of the web page. And there's another little really good book called From Atoms to Amperes. I should put notes on that up there. And I think Stuart Downs's article does a really good job too. And I think one of the most important things to realize in the whole thing is, and we could go on about this for hours, and I'm certainly not an authority, but it's kind of the way I've come to understand it, is got to realize this, that just as a changing, we all know from experiments we did in high school and studying this stuff, that if you have a changing magnetic field, it'll create an electric field in a nearby wire. That's the principle. That's how a transformer works. But the important thing to realize is that changing magnetic field, even if the wire is not there, will create a changing electric field in free space. And then it continues. And the speed that allows it to continue and that maintains the principle of the conservation of energy is C, and it all works out. And it's all the speed and the transfer of energy from the E field to the B field. It's all determined and it's built around the electrical characteristics of free space. And that works into Maxwell's equations, but for me I always had a tough time getting to that point where I understood that, yeah, okay, the changing magnetic field will create the changing electrical field in free space, even if that wire that's secondary of the transformer is not there. And for me, that was the real. Once I just sort of accepted that, then it became a lot easier to understand how the thing propagates. KL7RM 0HBR.
I don't know. Over my head. But it's one of those things where you have a conviction about, but no way to prove it, no reason for the conviction other than you know how it works in water, you know how it works in air. Seems like it ought to work the same way in space, but maybe not. Let's go on to the next subject there, Bill. Anyway, it was really interesting talking to this guy. He's a young fella. You know, his wife came up to Juneau and he kind of tagged along. But he's a really interesting fella. He's got some brain cells there at the BM, and I'm hoping to tap him. What was interesting, though, is that he's studying the aurora, and he's never been to Alaska before. He's from New York. So he has... No practical knowledge about how aurora affects ham radio, and he's going to get a face full of it up here. The propagation just goes away during auroral activity, so he'll get a practical feel for what those numbers mean, I think. what you've been working on there, Elvis?
Oh wow! It sounds like this guy's in the perfect territory there for a guy who's studying plasma. He'll have all that plasma visible overhead. Yes, I have actually melted some solder here, Mike. I'm happy to report. I told you in the last couple episodes that I've been playing with 17 meters again, and I've been kind of using this low-pass filter, this kind of external low-pass filter, out coming out of the 17-meter homebrew SSB transmitter. But it's as the Brits would say, I think the whole thing was a bit dodgy. I wasn't quite sure what the cutoff frequency was, and I wasn't really quite sure what the impedance for which the filter had been designed was, and it was clearly a situation that was unsatisfactory. And as we've gone through our discussions of class A and class AB amplifiers, I became more and more acutely aware of how these amplifiers are generating harmonics. So trying to be a good electromagnetic citizen, I decided it was time to put a real low-pass filter properly designed with a sufficient number of elements in there to protect the ionosphere from my QRP homebrew sideband signal. So it's the low-pass filters, the last thing thrown onto a lot of the transmitters that we work on, and you know they cause a lot of trouble. I've had projects in which I got the whole thing done, everything was working fine, and then I slapped on the low-pass filter, and it would the amplifier would take off, or it wouldn't put out sufficient power, or things just wouldn't work right. So I found this really great article in the AM QRP Homebrewer issue number 6. It's by, I'm going to hope I get his name pronounced right, I think it's Phil DeCare, call sign WB7AEI, Whiskey Bravo 7 Alpha Echo India. He's got a great article in there called Low Pass Filters for QRP Transmitters. Learn about those pesky output circuits we all use and how to optimize them. Phil's got a lot of really good information in there, and one of the points he makes is avoid putting the cutoff frequency too close to your operating frequency, which I think might have been part of my problem in the past. So using his guidelines in there, I built it's a 5-element filter, and I put it in there, and it works fine. And so I'm happy to report that I'm now I guess a good electromagnetic citizen here on 17 meters, or at least I'm improving. So that was my project. KL7R, what solder has been melted in Juneau? This is M0HBR.
Well, I had a similar experience. I've been playing with that SM0 VPO push pull 2N22 amp. You know, and I was trying to. I found out it was peaky after I looked at it again on LT Spice. Had a nice peak at 7 megahertz. So then I thought, well, I can use some of the knowledge that I've gained here recently or some of the techniques. I'm not going to say knowledge I've gained recently on flattening the gain. And so I put some feedback elements on the SM0 VPO push-pull amp on the driver amp, and I was able to get the gain flattened out pretty well. It's still 30 dB gain, the whole thing, and still puts out, if you drive it, it'll put out a watt, but it puts out a half a watt. And but I never did get, even in Spice, I couldn't figure out how to get the input impedance down to 50 ohms. I don't know. That's some more studying I got to do. But I went ahead and modified the circuit a little bit. I added a few extra components in true flying dead bug fashion, and and it did flatten it just exactly like spice. It flattened the gain out. The input impedance is something really odd. I don't know what it is exactly, but I did some soldering there. So then I put a signal in at 3 megs, and I 3.5 or 3.933 megs, and added my modular low pass filter at a 7 element low pass filter 50 ohm. I don't know what happened, but it went nuts. I started seeing all kinds of modulation or something, all kinds of weirdness going on when I added the output filter. So I guess that would either mean that my output filter isn't where I think it is, which I know it is. I know it's, and I think it cuts off at 4.5 megs or something. Or it means that my output impedance on that amp is also really bad. So I don't know what to do there, other than I have been melting solder and I have been trying to understand how to change the characteristics of the amplifier. You mentioned you had a handle on feedback on the you were going to get a handle on feedback on our last conversation. We were looking at the amplifier there in experimental methods from chapter 2 and the feedback on that. Did you get a handle on how the feedback works, or you want to save that for another issue there, Bill? Go ahead.
Yeah, time for feedback on feedback. But first on the low pass filters, one of the things that Phil points out in his article was, again, not to put the don't use a filter with too low a cutoff frequency. And I think he points out that, for example, for his 40 meter rig, he said don't use a cutoff below about 9 megahertz for a 40 meter rig. He points out you're in a bind because you want harmonic rejection, but you also want some output power. And he goes on to point out about how there's some magic in the I'm going to mispronounce this Chebyshev filter. And he says he gives some real good guidance there. So I think everybody's got these CDs from AMQRP are laying around, and I found this article to be really useful. So keep it handy, because as we know, these you put the filter on there, and as you said, everything gets messed up. Yeah, feedback. You know, Chebyshev. Okay, there comes the pronunciation through the magic of Echolink's text box. Great, thanks, Mike. The feedback. First of all, for your purposes, you might want to use the filter. I mean, the software that comes with experimental methods. There's a program on the disc. I think it's called FBA Feedback Amp, and you get to play with the parameters for the feedback resistance in the emitter, and the feedback values for the network that goes between the collector and the base. And as you play with them, it displays what's happening to input impedance, output impedance, and all that. And it's really really useful. But what I was struggling with last time, and it was I think I was sleep deprived or something, but I thought I understood it, then I couldn't, then I discovered that I really didn't understand it, but I think I understand it now. Here's what I was trying to understand. They always say that if you put unbypassed resistance in the emitter, that has the effect of increasing the input impedance of a common emitter BJT amp. Fine. I find that really easy to understand. The problem I had was I couldn't understand why it was that introducing feedback, a feedback network from the collector to the base, why that would have the effect of decreasing the input impedance of the same amp. And it wasn't at all intuitive to me, and I struggled with it, and I looked at a lot of the explanations that appear in a lot of the books and a lot of the formula, and somehow I just wasn't seeing it, and so I was struggling with it, and I finally got the understanding of it. I'm pretty sure. But basically, what's going on is you have to look at the phase of the input signal and how it relates to the phase of the signal at the collector. It's, you know, these amps in this configuration, they're, I guess, what you could call inverting. So what you're doing is you're introducing a current path for the RF back from the collector back to the base, to the input. And so as the input signal goes positive and starts, in essence, pulling electrons up through the emitter base junction, when you introduce that feedback network, you're basically taking a negative going signal, additional electrons from the collector, and allowing those electrons to flow through the feedback network out into the positive going signal provided by the input signal. So in essence, when you do this for the same input voltage, because of the feedback network, you are pulling more current through, and that's the definition of lower impedance. I hope that I make that clear. I wrote it up on the gadgeteer.us Gadgeteer News site, so if anybody wants to take a look at that, it's there, and please let me know if I have it wrong. I hope I don't. KL7R, M0HBR.
All right, Bill. Yeah, I think I looked at that and at your site there on that stuff. And, think that way, but I understood what you were saying, so I'll have to think about it a little bit more. We were given the suggestion that we should think about this as though it was an op amp, you know, for gain control. The gain in an op amp is completely determined by an op amp amplifier, completely determined by the controlling resistors, you know, feedback resistors. And a similar thing is happening with transistors. So I can see where the I don't understand the equivalent resistors that you would use for like an input resistor and a feedback resistor on an op amp. I'm not sure I understand what the equivalent resistors are for a transistor amplifier. Something I can look at here later. But that's that's cool, Bill. Let's see. So I did get stuck on impedance on that amp. I wanted to pass on the technique that we were shown there for determining input impedance, both in SPICE and experimentally there. Bill, go ahead.
Yeah, I know you've been really getting into the Smith charts, Mike, I think I told you that every time I look at a Smith chart, my head hurts. So, yeah, why don't you talk a little bit about that? This is becoming one of the more heavy theoretical issues of solder smoke, but that's fine. I guess we're in it. We might as well get into the Smith charts. Go ahead.
Well, I wasn't thinking Smith charts. I was thinking something easier there, Bill. As far as Smith charts, I sent you a link, but there's a place out there, I can't remember the name, RF Labs or something like that, has a bunch of Smith chart information, and towards the bottom of it, it's got the Smith chart, and it shows areas of the Smith chart if you're going to do impedance transformation where it's impossible to do the transformation if you're in certain zones of the Smith chart. And it turns out that these zones are are in the shape of a yin-yang symbol. That's all I was trying to pass along there, that and the fact that it was all sort of mystical, Bill. But what I wanted to talk about was something simpler. Was using the 6 dB return loss bridge and using a resistor and a voltage source in SPICE there. Go ahead.
Well, go ahead. This sounds interesting. Go ahead.
Well, if you want to measure an antenna, you can use if you want to measure, relative match on an antenna, you use an SWR meter. You use a signal source, your rig, use an SWR meter, and then your load is the antenna. And the antenna basically acts like a tuned circuit and has lowest SWR at resonance when the antennas and feed lines all tuned up. So if you replace the antenna with an LC circuit, there will also be a place where the LC circuit is resonant. And so what would be cool is to be able to measure the impedance at the LC circuit or at the input of a transistor. And you could do the same thing with a signal source and an SWR meter. SWR shows the amount of meter shows the amount of reflected energy coming out back from a bad matched if you had a perfect match you would have no reflected energy, so you would have a 1-to-1 SWR. And a return loss bridge does the same thing, only you're measuring just the reflected energy. And if the reflected energy is very low, then you have a very good match. So a very high return loss is a very low SWR and a very good match. It's very close to 50 ohms J0. And so if you look in experimental methods, there's a schematic in there for building a return loss bridge. It's like one ferrite and a transformer and three resistors, I think, 350 ohm resistors. So really easy to build, and it's really useful to do. So you take your signal and you put it the input of the return loss bridge, and the output you hitch the unknown you hitch to the your transistor amp, and then the amount of return loss comes out the third port, and you measure that with either a oscilloscope or a power meter or something like that. So that's how you do it experimentally, and to do it in SPICE is slightly different there, Bill. M0HBR, KL7R.
Oh, well, this sounds really useful. Yeah, this sounds like one of those pieces of test gear that we all need. It sounds a lot like what's inside the MFJ antenna analyzer boxes. Wow, I want to get one of these. Because that's the big problem, and is figuring out what you're looking into when you start, especially when you're doing the kind of home brewing, the kind of hacking that we're engaged in, Mike, where you're saying, hey, I think I'll take this bit of circuitry from this QST article and match it up with this other thing that came from the 1967 issue of 73 magazine, and put it all together and see if it'll work. That's the kind of hacking that I've been doing for years, and that there's a crying need to have it more testable, more measurable, and more systematic. I was when you consider some of the stuff that we mix together. I was just looking at the 17 meter SSB transmitter that I've been using, and I didn't even realize it, but I have a crystal filter from a Swan 240 transceiver with four individual crystals making up the filter, and the crystals were manufactured in 1962. And then less than 2 inches away from them, I have the heterodyne mixer for the transmitter that takes the frequency up to 18 megs, and that's an NE602. So I've got an NE602 made for cell phones within 2 inches of the 1962 crystals. When we're working on projects like this, we really have a need for the kind of the kind of testing and measuring that you're describing, KL7RM0HBR.
Right, Bill. So that's basically how you'd measure it, for real. But what'd be, what's interesting is it's really easy to do it in SPICE too. What you can do is you can set when you do a simulation in SPICE, you can do a decade sweep, and so you can look at the gain over a frequency range, like from 1 to 30 megs or something like that. You can find out how flat the amp is or how peaky the amp is. If you do that, you usually have to set an AC source. It doesn't like to be driven with regular sine wave. You have to set it as an AC source. It's clear when you look in there. But what you do is you set an AC source for 2 volts. And then you go through a 50-ohm load, a 50-ohm. So basically you have a 50-ohm source at 2 volts. And the trick here is that you basically shunt to ground, not really shunt to ground, you aim towards the ground, a 1-volt source. So if you drew a picture, you'd have a 2-volt AC and a 50-ohm resistor in series, you'd have a 1-volt AC, and basically the other end would be open of the 1-volt AC, and then the junction between the 50-ohm resistor and the 1-volt AC would be the input to your amp. So what's going on here is you set the 2-volt AC, and the 2-volt is going into your transistor. If your transistor was a 50-ohm load, the whole 2 volts would be dumped into the resistor. So you would measure 1 volt at the open end of the 1 volt AC source. So basically 2 volts minus 1 volt is 1 volt. You'd measure 1 volt at the AC source. 1 volt is a convenient number on a Smith chart. goes in there. If you have a reflected energy coming back from the input to the transistor or your tuned circuit, the output will be higher than 1 volt at the open end of the sensor site, which is at the bottom end of your 1-volt AC source. That's hard to describe. I need to draw a picture here, I can tell. But anyway, it's simple. With a 2-volt, 1 resistor, and a 1-volt, you can measure return loss directly. And with SPICE, the return loss also includes phase. So given the voltage between minus 1 volt, 0, and 1 volt,
I see what you're saying, but you're right. We need a whiteboard. We need all those MP3 players to have a little screen on them. I'm sure that's coming. but don't worry, Mike, because I was having my problems last week were far worse than yours. I had got the thing completely upside down and backwards. You've got it right. No, I see what you're saying. It's essentially a bridge, and then you can combine the information and put it on LT Spice and probably get more information out of it than you would just from the voltage measurement. So you're combining LT Spice's features with real world measurement and getting a better picture of what's happening in terms of the input impedance, including the complex elements, right?
But yeah, basically at this sensor site, which is basically the place where you measure return loss as though you were measuring it with a return loss bridge, you can measure both phase and the amount of return loss, or the amount of match, which is equivalent to the amount of the match that your amp has at 50 ohms or whatever you're set for. So it's really easy to set it up in LT Spice, and I'll post a an example or two on there on how to set this up. But it's really useful to be able to tune your amp's feedback circuitry so that the input impedance is 50 ohms. And if you would, if you take the, you can do that. You can measure the input impedance using this little circuit, and I'll post this. But what stunned me was that you can use the same exact circuit to measure output impedance. And you can use, you know, so basically you inject a small bit of AC into the, if you were to measure output impedance, you would inject a small, you set up a circuit like this and measure current going backwards into the amp with a little bit of AC on the collector. And I think just the action of the collector wiggling changes the bias enough to where you can actually measure a return loss looking backwards into the amp. The input has to be basically set to 50 ohms with a 50 ohm resistor. So you set a 50 ohm resistor on the input, and you wiggle the output with a return loss bridge. And you would think you would blow up your sig jams, but I did it, and it doesn't happen. So as long as you're careful, you can actually, you know, transmit with a, you know, 0 dBm sig gen into a 100 milliwatt or 500 milliwatt amplifier. As long as the amplifier is not actually transmitting, you can actually measure output return loss by transmitting into the output of an amplifier. It's really odd, but it works. And I'll put a couple circuits up to describe that. M0HBR, KL7R.
KL7R, M0HBR. Yeah, you know, that output impedance parameter is really important, and it's something that I haven't been thinking about too much, because I'm always focused on selecting the right or the optimal load for the amplifier. Of course, that's important, especially if you want to stay in Class A, and I've been playing with a lot of Class A amplifiers, because you want to pick a load that will allow you to avoid saturation. But then you know, I was thinking about this as I was playing with the 17 meter rig. Unless we try to keep that output impedance as seen, as you say, looking back into the amplifier, unless we keep that at 50 ohms, as far as I can tell, if you end up with an amplifier that has an output impedance that's significantly different from 50 ohms, the amplifier might work properly, but when you measure SWR on the with your standard SWR output meter, it's never going to be 1-to-1, because you've got, you know, okay, even if you have, you know, a 50 ohm line and a perfectly matched 50 ohm antenna, back at the other end you don't have 50 ohms, so there's going to be standing waves there, and I hope I'm right about that, because I mean sometimes. You know, if you end up with an amplifier, you think everything's going well, and for some reason you just can't get with that particular amplifier, you can't get the SWR down to 1-to-1. And sometimes that could be an indication that you've got harmonics coming out, and there's some energy on there at a frequency that for which the antenna is not matched. But it also could be that the output impedance of the amplifier that you've ended up with is significantly different from 50 ohms. So that makes that understanding that important. But three cheers to you, Mike, because this is some heavy stuff, and sounds like you've made some real big progress both at the workbench on LT Spice and then just scratching your head too. So great. This points up the usefulness of being able to do screen capture videos with LT Spice. It'd be great to not just post the final product, but to post a video. We could do LT Spice meets YouTube, and just you could talk us through it, and we could see as you change the parameters and how it changes the waveforms, and as you do the transient analysis. It'd be really good. And thanks to the guys from from amateurlogic.tv. George sent me the software that they've been using for screen capture, and if I get time this weekend, I'm going to try to mash it up with LT Spice, and well, we could open up an entire new a new section of YouTube. LT Spice, it'll be a refreshing refreshing change from all the drunk college student videos that are that seem to be out there. Wow, we've covered a lot of territory here, a lot of technical stuff. We might have to recommend that people bring a few aspirin with them when they come here, because this is some heavy stuff, but I think people will find it interesting. KL7R, M0HPR.
Yeah, I wish I hadn't stuttered so bad on that. It really is really simple, and I think a picture is worth 1,000 words, so maybe, I did find that Wink software for that does flash captures of a session, of an application session. Maybe I'll do that. Maybe it's worth doing, and maybe I can set up a Wink or something session, or if you plan to do that, well, you're going to work on, if you plan to do that, that I'll just let you do it. But if you want me to do the thing on input and output impedance measuring using the S parameters. It's a phrase that I that's related to the return loss in and gain through the amp and return loss out. I'll do that. I just think it's just really cool that you can actually measure return loss in Spice, and you can actually measure it with a return loss bridge. It's clear that would have worked on the input of an amp. It just really was not clear to me that would have worked on an output of an amp. To measure the output using the same technique you used to measure the input just flabbergasted me. But it's cool that you can. So yeah, maybe I'll make an effort to write that up a little bit there, Bill. I'm actually getting a little tired here. I did want to mention, remember we were talking about your Class C amps? I two things I wanted to mention. Your Class C amps, and we're talking about maybe doing a pulse width modulation of Class C amps. And you mentioned AM radio, and we both didn't know whether it would work with double sideband and sideband. Anyway, there's a guy out there called ClassEradio.com that has been doing a bunch of that high level plate modulation, basically using pulse width modulator, and he's using like a cascode arrangement of FETs, and it seems like you could do a dual cascode. I forget the name of the circuit that's the core of an NE602, but basically it seems like you could use a dual cascode arrangement like the core of the NE602, a Gilbert cell, and do the same thing he's doing. So classyradio.com. I don't know if you're going to mention the fellow who was doing etching of circuit boards with electrolysis, but if not, I'll mention it later there, Bill. M0HBR, KL7R.
KL7R, M0HBR. Yeah, well, yeah, a lot of interesting stuff. One thing I did want to do, because we have a fellow radio amateur in need, that brings us to this week's segment of Standby. Oops, hold on. Man, oh, there we go, hold on. Name That Noise. A couple things on the Name That Noise segment. We mentioned last week a website, I think we mentioned it, that where you can get samples of all kinds of digital signals. And this appeared in Steve Ford's article in the December issue of QST, but I've taken the link. It's a site in France. Some French radio amateurs have it there. and I posted it on the Gadgeteer.us Gadgeteer News site, if anybody's interested. And I understand that the ARRL also has a site for RFI, and you can listen to different types of RFI on that site. I'll try to get the site and put it up on the news page. And that brings us to a fellow radio amateur in need. One of our most loyal and most distant listeners is Ramakrishnan. He's in Bangalore, and he sends us mail fairly regularly, a big solder smoke fan. Ramakrishnan's having some really awful RFI problems. He's in an apartment in the Bangalore area, where, as we all know, is an intensely electronic part of India, so a lot of RF around, and he is unable to operate on the ham bands because of the immense amount of RFI that he has. And we're looking for suggestions and help from the solder smoke community. One thing he mentioned caught my attention, Mike, was that he doesn't have a good RF ground, and he's on the he's one floor up from ground level, and the water pipes in the building are not metal, so that doesn't provide a good way to do it. And I was going to suggest either trying to drop a thick cable down out the window and try to get a ground stake in there, or failing that, it might be the old trick of throwing a quarter wave wire out the window at the desired operating frequency, and that'll serve as sort of a kind of an artificial ground. But we'll be looking for suggestions for Ramakrishnan, and that is our story of the week in the Name That Noise segment, KL7RM0HBR.
Well, I've got a lot of personal experience in living in apartments and what all second floor apartments, and the solution to that is balanced antennas. That really helps a lot for noise. It also helps a lot for keeping out of your neighbor's TV sets, and helps a lot for keeping RF off your mic jack if you're doing PSK. He mentioned the power went away, the noise went away during a power outage, so maybe he can DF that noise with an AM radio and an antenna. Let's see, you have anything else there, Bill? Go ahead.
Well, Billy's arrived on the scene here, pretty much on schedule. Got a bit of a cold, but nothing serious. And, you know, we've had some requests. Mike sent in a request saying that he missed the gong, so... Solder smoke mailbag. Let's see. We got a... In response to our stories about the antennas visible from space via Google Earth, Gene, AK9N, sent us a very nice picture showing antennas visible from space, the very large array out there in the desert, the big radio telescope. That was fun. Thanks for that. Jason, N2NLY, from the Big Apple, sends in a picture of the New York Hall of Science, and vertical antennas, or at least the shadow of them, are visible up on the roof of one of the buildings. And that was a nice shot. I think that was the old World's Fair site. Jason, correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember going to that one, 1966, out there near Shea Stadium. I think that's what you're talking about. And we got a nice email from Jerry, NR5A, inquiring about our health here after the London tornado. All okay, Jerry? We got through it. no problem. It hit one very specific neighborhood, and one street was affected. So we're just fine. A couple other things, not really in the mailbag, but I found a book, and it is just so solder smoke-ish that I feel compelled to mention it. So I guess we're in the book review segment. And it's called Gonzo Gizmos. And Gonzo Gizmos by Simon Kellen Field. Gonzo Gizmos, projects and devices to channel your inner geek. This is the kind of thing we need. Build film can cannons, levitating magnets, Gauss rifles, laser radios, and more. Clearly, this is the kind of book that we all need. And I found it in a while rummaging through a used comic book store in West London. I found my copy, but it's in print. And I, if you go to the gadgeteer.us Gadgeteer News thing, you'll see a bit about it and how to get your own copy. Really cool stuff in there. For example, high voltage. How to get really high voltage in a safe way at really low maximum currents so that you could do all kinds of electrostatic experiments. And he takes a big piece of aluminum foil, puts it on the screen of his television set, and then attaches that to a Coke can, which serves as one element of a big capacitor. And I thought that was pretty neat. So anyway, Gonzo Gizmos. Like I said, we put some stuff on Homebrew Tubes on Gadgeteer News. Oh, yeah, there was a really good email on the NE602 story, and I put that on gadgeteer.news for all you guys who were interested in the status of NE602s, the different varieties, why there are rumors from time to time that that the device will be no longer produced. A very informative email there posted on the gadgeteer.news website. One other question I'll throw out there to the gang. If I have sitting here with me a TRS-80 Model 100 computer, and I hear rumors from time to time that people are actually using this for ham radio purposes, and I feel compelled to put it in use. I mean, if I'm using 1962 crystals, I should be able to use a 1983, the original laptop. And I understand that Mr. Gates actually wrote some of the code for this thing. So anyway, please let me know if you think there's an appropriate use to which, for radio amateur use, that a TRS-80 Model 100 computer can be put to. And related, I understand from make.com, the make scene, that Altair kits are now available again. So talk about channeling your inner geek. All right, Mike. I think that we might as well wrap it up. I think we're pushing the time limit here. Time to go down and get some breakfast. Time for you to go horizontal, and we'll wrap this up one now. This one up now. Over to you for a final. KL7R M0HBR.
All right, M0HBR KL7R. Well, I got a comment. Two things. One is the TRS-80 is an RF hash generator deluxe. We used two of them in a contest station in Fairbanks. We ran CQ Worldwide, and I think we won CQ Worldwide, or maybe it was WPX. We had something like 10,000 contacts or 11,000 in 2 days. But we had to put the two trash 80s. When you say trash, it's part quality, part RF hash. Inside of a room, and the room had to be shielded with chicken wire for the databases for the contest station, because the TRS-80s were so noisy across the band. Plug it in, and you'll see what I'm talking about. It's amazing how noisy it is. And the other thing is that we did get a mail message from Gregory O'Brien, NE1OB, that I thought was really great. He did a variation on my Scrimshaw PC board technique, and his variation was that instead of using etchant, he used a salt solution and a 12 volt battery through a light bulb to limit the current, and he used the 12 volt to do electrolysis to remove the unprotected circuit board areas that hadn't been masked, and I thought that was great. All right, Bill. Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting a little rest this weekend, and maybe I'll get caught up on a few things. So have a good day there, Bill, and catch you next week maybe there. Have a good morning, Billy. M0HBR, KL7R clear.
There we are. Okay. All right, Mike. Well, Billy will say hello to the Cider Smoke Gang.
Hi.
There you go. All right, transmitting worldwide. All right, yeah, get some rest. Have a good weekend. We'll compare notes next week. Everybody out there, please keep the emails coming in. We really love to hear from everybody. You can send it to the Cider Smoke mailing address, or you can send it to n2cqr at ARRL.net, and we'll do our best to get the email mentioned on the show. But it's just great to be able to compare notes with people who get such great ideas, and the feedback is always welcome. So Mike, 7-3, good luck with the snow, and enjoy the aurora, and keep on melting solder up there in Juneau. 7-3, KL7R, and the group, M0HBR.